We're now halfway through the spring term of our 60th year, and it's Valentine's Day, and I'd like to congratulate a member who's been a regular member from the very first year on Valentine's Day, Mrs. Sherwood Lett, and who's here in the audience today. We're very fortunate tonight in having a topic which has been interesting to man almost perhaps longer than any other problem. This is the topic of cosmology. We have today a young professor, Dr. Virginia Trimble, who shares her time at the moment between the University of Maryland and the University of California at Irvine. She comes from the places where all the world's best astronomers come from. She started at Caltech and got her training at Cambridge, two of perhaps the most important centers in the world at present. And like most astronomers, she travels a great deal. She's had some very prestigious scholarships. I should also mention that we are very grateful to Sigma Si, who has brought her out here for this visit. This is her first visit to Canada and her first visit to British Columbia. She's a desert person, so she feels rather strange here in winter in British Columbia. But we're very pleased to have her here today talking on cosmology, man's place in the universe. Dr. Virginia Trimble. I should add she was also a professional singer and claims she can do without this, but we're going to try having...
You see the difficulty, it sort of gets snarled in with the hair.
Oh, I missed it.
Lovely. Sort of an umbilical cord. If I don't break my neck over this umbilical cord, what I want to do for this evening is to sort of review the history of the universe from the Big Bang to the birth of Prime Minister Trudeau, and show you how this follows in a more or less necessary way just from the very fundamental physical constants of our universe, and indicate to you what a mess we would be in if our universe weren't just about the way it is. I guess the first thing to do, perhaps, is to put you in some sort of reference frame of how people fit into the universe between astronomical phenomena and the phenomena of atomic physics. So if I could have the first large slide. This is a time scale. My people time is 1 minute. That's the average attention span of a member of the Vancouver Institute. And I've taken the age of the universe and the time scale of nuclear decays as representative of the astronomical universe and the world of atomic physics. And notice that they're the same number of zeros before the decimal place at the top as there are after the decimal place at the bottom. In other words, a people time scale is sort of an average between universal phenomena and atomic phenomena. And the next large slide is a scale of masses. And I've taken as my typical people mass, 140 pounds, maybe a little larger in here, actually. And again, the mass of the sun and the mass of the atom just span this equal amounts on either side. And the next large slide is a size scale, and a typical people scale is a couple of meters, 6 feet in SI units. And as an astronomical scale, we have something in the solar system and the size of an atomic nucleus. And again, people fit right in the middle in the size scale between astronomical phenomena and the phenomena of atomic physics. So it shouldn't be absolutely hopeless to look for some relationship between both astronomy and atomic physics and the fact that we happen to be here on a rainy Saturday night on Valentine's Day, that is, between the universe as a large-scale thing and the existence of people in it. So what we need to do is to look at the history of the universe. And this goes back about 20 billion years. And the first thing we have any direct evidence for is a time about 20 billion years ago when the universe was much hotter and much denser than it is now. had a temperature of some billions of degrees and a density of many grams per cubic centimeter. The result of this was that nuclear reactions occurred, generated energy, generated photons, generated neutrinos and gravitons and all the rest of the zoo of fundamental particles. This early hot dense phase people sometimes call the Big Bang. And sometimes people get just a little mystical about the Big Bang, and they want to know things like what caused it and what went before and what was God thinking of. But the problem is that this hot dense phase itself wiped out any evidence that we might have had for what went before. So there really isn't much use asking. It's rather as if you put your automobile back into the blast furnace and melted it down again to steel and puddles and things, and then asked what sort of car it had been. There wouldn't really be any way by looking at the puddle to tell what sort of car you'd had. And similarly, the hot, dense phase wiped out the evidence of what went before in our universe. But coming out of this hot, dense phase, we find some light, some neutrinos, some gravitons, and some matter in the form of hydrogen and helium and nothing else. And it's lucky for us that that isn't all that happened, because obviously the chemistry of hydrogen and helium isn't very interesting. And if there'd never been anything else, clearly we wouldn't be here. Also, if this stuff had just expanded forever uniformly, at this point you would find that if you were a hydrogen atom, you would spend your entire life and never even meet another hydrogen atom, because the average density of matter in the universe is something like one atom per cubic meter. So it would be rather a lonely existence if nothing else had happened but the Big Bang. Luckily, that wasn't all that happened. And the next important thing is that the force of gravity begins to take over and pulls the matter together into largish lumps. We call these lumps galaxies. Initially, they consist of gas and dust, hydrogen and helium, and they are the raw materials from which stars eventually form. If we can have the first small slide. This is a sort of a primitive galaxy. There we are, primitive galaxy. Almost no stars here yet, mostly gas and dust. The next small slide is a galaxy in which some star formation has occurred. And you see in the middle still some gas and dust and stars on either side of it. And the next small slide is a galaxy in which star formation is pretty well complete. Nearly all the gas and dust has been turned into stars like our sun. That galaxy, in fact, contains about 200 billion stars. It's a typical number for a galaxy. In fact, if you could collect a dollar from each of those stars, it would pay off about half the American national debt. It says something either about galaxies or about the national debt. The really spooky thing is that when I started as a Sigma Xi national lecturer a year and a half ago, a dollar from each of those stars would have paid off the entire national debt. The next small slide is a galaxy rather like our own. In fact, it's the Whirlpool Nebula. And I'm sorry to report that the little bright thing in the bottom is not something that was blown out of the galaxy. In fact, it's a background object. That's a so-called spiral galaxy. What you're seeing is gas and dust in the spiral arms that has not yet been turned into stars, and stars between the arms. The next small slide is our sister twin galaxy, the so-called Great Nebula in Andromeda. If we could step outside our own stellar system and look back, it would look rather like this. And our little solar system would be an invisibly small dot, not at the center, not any place special, just about two-thirds of the way from the center to the outside of that disk. Okay, out of the hot Big Bang comes hydrogen and helium. It collects together in these lumps that we call, I don't really want the lights. Thank you. That we call galaxies. And the gas and dust in the galaxies starts condensing to form stars. The next small slide is a region in which star formation has started to occur. What you see there is some blue dots, which are hot, newly formed stars. And surrounding it, some raw material, some gas that has not yet condensed and is being lit up by the stars. That, of course, is the Great Nebula in Orion, sort of the middle star in Orion's sword. If you look at Orion, even with opera glasses, you can tell that his sword is not just a star, but this cloud of gas and dust lit up by stars. And the next small slide, we see some brand new formed hot stars just condensed out of the interstellar medium, again, still with some gas and dust around, although they've blown away most of it. That, of course, is the Pleiades. And the first generation of stars would have looked like the Pleiades. The stars would all have been very hot, very massive, rather blue, and made of pure hydrogen and helium. We call a star like this that has just condensed out of the interstellar medium a newborn main sequence star. And if we can have the next large slide, we see here a main sequence star. Notice he has two sunspots and a prominence in the middle and sort of a corona around his head. And the next large slide, you see what he does for a living. He converts hydrogen to helium. It's not as pleasant a living as being an astronomer, I suspect. But that's what stars do for a living, and that's what our sun is doing. It's been converting hydrogen to helium in its interior for about 5 billion years. It will continue to do so for another 5 billion years. One of the things you don't have to worry about this week is the sun running out of fuel, you know, unless you spend a lot of time worrying about things that won't happen for 5 billion years. But even our sun eventually will run out of its hydrogen fuel. In the next large slide, we see a star that has just exhausted its hydrogen, has developed a core of pure helium. And the next large slide, we see that helium core condensing and the outer layers of the star expanding. A star doing this we call a red giant. And we see large numbers of these in the night sky. For instance, if it ever clears out here and stops raining, on a nice dark winter's night, you can go out and look up and see the constellation of Orion. And again, the middle star of his sword is the Orion Nebula, where stars have just started forming. His left shoulder is a very bright red star called Betelgeuse, which is a typical red giant. It's a star that has exhausted hydrogen in its interior. The center has contracted and the outer layers have expanded. The next large slide, you see that in due course, the helium gets so hot that it undergoes further nuclear reactions that produce carbon and oxygen. That's getting to be interesting from our point of view because, after all, we are basically made of carbon and oxygen. Something like 90% of our mass, typically, is carbon and oxygen. Most of the rest is things like calcium in the bones, and we'll get to calcium in a minute. Okay, a star converts helium to carbon and oxygen in its interior. Again, we see stars in the process of doing this. They're called horizontal branch stars, but I don't think you need to worry about that. The next large slide, again, an inert core develops and the outer layers expand. This picture is not to scale. In fact, more than half the mass of the star is still in the form of the original hydrogen-rich envelope. Notice the two thin shells in which nuclear reactions continue to occur. The scale of these drawings actually was determined by the sizes of jar lids I had available the day I did the pictures. I explained this at Los Alamos the other day, and they gave me a compass. Now I know which way is north. The next large slide, we see that the carbon-oxygen core has grown until it fills virtually the entire star. And the typical core of this sort contains about as much mass as our sun, say half to 1.5 solar masses. The density is tremendous. If you had a cubic inch of material from such a star, you could not pick it up because it would weigh several tons. We call a star like this a white dwarf. The next large slide is a typical white dwarf. Notice the sunspots have gone, largely because the convection has gone. The prominence is gone, but notice the beginnings of a dipole magnetic field up there. And indeed, an average white dwarf has a magnetic field of something like 10,000 to a million Gauss. That is stronger than anything we can develop in the laboratory at the present time. This will be the eventual fate of our sun. About 5 billion years from now, it will first expand as a red giant and then finally contract and cool off as a tiny little white dwarf. The average size of a white dwarf is about the diameter of the Earth, but it contains enough material to make a whole star, and that's why it's so dense. Is Robert Frost red in Canada, or is he purely a U.S. phenomenon? Is he red in Canada? Then the answer to his question about fire and ice is first fire and then ice, as the sun first becomes a red giant and then a white dwarf. But again, you needn't worry about it this week. So, our sun will end its life as a white dwarf, and so do all other stars of the sun's size. Notice that the carbon and oxygen that the sun so carefully made gets trapped inside, so that the heavy elements that we're made of were not created in little dinky stars like the sun. We're going to have to go on and consider other more massive stars. And the next large slide should be, yes, that's a more massive star whose interior gets hot enough that the carbon and oxygen undergo further nuclear reactions to form things like magnesium and silicon and calcium and sulfur, the intermediate weight chemical elements that are important constituents of terrestrial rocks and, of course, important raw materials in terrestrial industry. In the next large slide, we have a magnesium-silicon core building up and contracting. The next large slide, we see that in due course, the core gets hot enough that yet another series of nuclear reactions begins. This is where the jar lid started breaking down. Again, not to scale, but you see the core of magnesium and silicon and so forth undergoing yet further nuclear reactions to make elements like iron and cobalt and nickel. This is going to be a critical stage for the star because iron is a very special element. You cannot get any energy out of nuclear reactions involving iron. It's like trying to get money out of the government. It just can't be done. So we see in the next large slide a star building up an inert core of iron. And when that happens, its nuclear reactions are pretty well through. That core gradually grows. And in the next large slide, we see that the core builds up until it contains about 1.5 times the mass of our sun. Remember, this was initially a very big star with enough mass for 10 or 20 suns all in one star. When the core gets to be about 1.5 solar masses, disaster intervenes. The disaster that occurs is a sudden collapse caused by the protons and the electrons in the iron getting together and forming neutrons. To an audience of physicists, one would say that what happens is that the Fermi energy of the electrons climbs above the neutron-proton mass difference. The important thing is that when you put a proton and an electron together to make a neutron, the neutron is very much smaller than the proton plus the electron that you started with. It's smaller by about a factor of 100,000 in diameter, or a factor of 1 followed by 15 zeros in volume. So when the electrons and protons start combining in this iron core, the core collapses suddenly, and I mean suddenly even by human standards, within a second or so, and catastrophically releasing vast amounts of energy which blow off the outer layers of the star. The next large slide is a star that has just undergone such a sudden and catastrophic collapse and explosion. The central part of the star is left as a very dense, 1 followed by 15 zeros roughly, grams per cubic centimeter. We call this thing a neutron star. We see them in the form of pulsars. A typical one is only something like 10 miles across. It would fit very nicely between here and Victoria, apart from the fact, of course, that it would immediately fall to the center of the Earth because of being so dense. And again, the outer layers of the star are blown off. And in the next small slide, we see the remnants of a star that underwent such a collapse and explosion. Yes. Thank you. And now push forward. Lovely. That's the Crab Nebula. Back in the year 1054, in fact, on July 4th, 1054, presumably some sort of premature bicentennial celebration, the Chinese astronomers recorded what they called a guest star in the constellation they called Tian Quan, which turns out to be the constellation we now know as Taurus. What they saw was a great outburst of light, which represented the process of blowing the outer layers off the star. What we now see is those outer layers expanding outward in a cloud of gas. The red and the white light there represent different chemical elements that happen to show up at different places in the nebula. And that material is something like 2 or 3 or 5 solar masses worth, enough to make several stars. And that cloud now contains largish amounts of the various heavier chemical elements that were made in the star during its lifetime. That is, this kind of explosion, which we call a supernova, puts into the interstellar medium carbon and oxygen and magnesium and sulfur and iron and so on and so forth. In fact, all the elements on beyond iron, gold and silver and lead and uranium and all the rest, are made in the explosion itself by rapidly adding neutrons to iron. That's why things like gold are rather rare, because they're only made in the explosion. And this explosion distributes the heavy elements back into the interstellar medium from which new generations of stars are going to form. We, in this case, actually see the remnant star. Figure out how this curious device works. Marvelous. Steady, Virginia, steady. That one is the remnant neutron star. We know that this is so because it manifests itself as a pulsar. That is, the light coming from it is not coming steadily, but is coming in bursts about 30 per second. So if you had very sharp eyes, you could go out on a dark night and see the star winking at you. You shouldn't tell anybody this. They won't believe you. But if one has sufficiently accurate electronic apparatus, one can see the star winking on and off as the little tiny neutron star rotates and points its bright side first toward us and away from us. And that's how we can tell which of the stars it is that is the actual remnant of the supernova explosion itself. Okay, the first generation of stars makes heavy elements by nuclear reactions in their interiors. Supernova explosions distribute the heavy elements out into the interstellar medium. Can we have some light on the subject now? Lovely, thank you. And then the next generation of stars that forms contains some heavy elements. And that means that there can be planets like the Earth formed, which are capable of sustaining chemical living creatures. Not only does the second generation of stars have the raw materials for planets, but each planet starts its life with a legacy of sort of interesting molecules. This is something we've only realized within the last few years, that if we look carefully at the interstellar medium using radio telescopes, we can detect the presence between these stars of various and sundry molecules of sorts that we know familiarly here on the Earth. For instance, there's interstellar methane. That's the stuff you burn in a gas stove. There's interstellar ammonia. That's the foul-smelling stuff you scrub windows with. There's interstellar water vapor. There's interstellar formaldehyde. That's that preservative stuff that you can get to put on your fingernails if you want to have vampire-type claws. You mustn't drink it, though, because it will preserve your interior in an awkward fashion. There's interstellar silicon dioxide. That's what we know as sand. There's interstellar cyanogen and formamine and formamide. There's interstellar methyl alcohol, which is rubbing alcohol. And there's interstellar ethyl alcohol, and you all know what that's good for. In fact, at the center of our galaxy, there's a cloud that contains enough ethyl alcohol to produce something like 100 million bottles of high-quality Canadian whiskey, which the government would be unable to tax. The only difficulty, of course, is to bring it back from there. Okay, every planet that forms then starts its life with a legacy of these molecules like methane and ammonia and water vapor and cyanogen and so forth. This is exceedingly interesting from a biochemical point of view because along about 20 years ago, Harold Urey suggested, and two of his colleagues, Fox and Miller, demonstrated in the laboratory, that if you take a large pot and you fill it with a mixture of these foul-smelling gases, and then you add some energy in the form of, say, ultraviolet radiation or an electric current, and you let the thing sit there and cook and stew for a while. When you come back and open your box, you will find some of the stuff you put in left, but you will also find that some chemical reactions have occurred and have manufactured things like amino acids, which are the raw materials of protein, and nucleic acids, which are the raw materials of DNA, the stuff that controls the heredity of terrestrial living creatures. And if you put your pot back and add some more energy and some enzymes and let it stew a while longer, you can actually make for yourself some proteins and some almost nucleic acid that just barely fails to reproduce and so forth. In other words, you can carry out in your laboratory the chemical reactions that must have occurred on Earth when it was young and healthy, that led up to the macromolecules that the first cells were composed of. There is a gap here in the laboratory evidence. We have not yet actually made the first string of nucleic acid that will genuinely reproduce itself from raw materials. This may be just as well, of course, because you may make this first nucleic acid and discover it eats biochemists. And then you have a problem, what to do with it, what to keep it in. So we don't quite know how long it takes to get this first self-replicating creature. We know that it happened on Earth. We will know within about a year, probably, if the batteries don't fail, whether it happened on Mars independently or not, because the Mariner probes that are on their way will have landing devices with life detection experiments. And if there's anything on Mars that is capable of self-replication, whose chemistry is even vaguely similar to that of terrestrial living creatures, we will know about it in a couple of years, again, if the apparatus doesn't fail. And if we can demonstrate that life has come into being twice in one solar system, we'll be pretty sure that it is really very common in the universe. Alternatively, if we can make it happen in the laboratory, we can be pretty sure that it's going to be very common in the universe. And once you have self-replication, then something like natural selection takes over, and the evolution from a primeval slime mold to Richard Nixon is practically inevitable. Okay. If all this is so natural, from the Big Bang to the forming of galaxies, to the forming of stars, to the forming of solid planets like the Earth with their legacy of molecules that then lead to proteins and DNA, it sounds as if we should probably not be alone in the universe. There should be other civilizations, other places, with which we can communicate. And, though of course there are people who are sure they know about these other civilizations. They tell us that flying saucers come and land in their corn patches and take them for rides. These people generally have other problems as well. But nevertheless, if all this is so natural, there should be other civilizations around. And we can make some sort of stab at calculating how many there should be. If I could have the next large slide. Oh, I forgot. The next large slide is a neutron star, the center of the Crab Nebula. It has a strong dipole magnetic field. And if there are any physicists in the audience, you notice the beginnings of the quantization of vorticity up there because the interior is a superfluid. Two weak giggles from two physicists. Okay. The next large slide is a star going down the tubes to form a black hole. This happens to some massive stars. The idea is everything goes down and nothing comes up. Could we have the room lights out for a second? So that once the gravitational field of the black hole becomes sufficiently strong, not even light can get out, and we get something that looks like the next large slide prepared at great expense. There we are. That's a black hole. Okay. If these processes occur as we think, there should be lots of other civilizations in the universe. Let's see how many. The next large slide starts, with the 200 billion stars in our galaxy, one per every $2 of the national debt. It won't do, incidentally, to collect a $2 bill from each one because the United States doesn't have $2 bills. So if you collect a $2 bill from each one, it's either Canadian, which won't do us any good, or it's fake, it's counterfeit, and that won't do any good either. Okay, we start with 200 billion possible stars. We're going to eliminate half of them right off the bat because they come in pairs. They're called binary systems, two stars in close orbit around one another. We eliminate those because if you try to put a planet in orbit around a pair of stars, you have a three-body system. And of course, psychologists always tell us that three-body systems are unstable. What generally happens is either the system disrupts completely or the odd body goes off to infinity. And the result is that you cannot put a planet in a stable orbit very easily in a binary system. So we'll leave those out. But that still leaves us with 100 billion stars. There's no great shortage. We're also going to eliminate some of the stars which are very short-lived. I've called those the O, B, and A stars. That comes from an ancient and honorable classification system that was figured out in Harvard at the turn of the century. The work was done by a woman named Annie J. Cannon, and therefore the catalog is called the Henry Draper Catalog. And she assigned to the stars in the sky spectral types which tell us their surface temperatures and therefore a very great deal about their masses and how long they'll live and so forth. The OBNA stars all have very short lifetimes. We're going to eliminate those because the evidence from Earth is that it takes at least a billion years to get that first slime mold. The Earth was more than a billion years old before the very first fossils were put down. So we'll leave out the short-lived stars. We'll also leave out the very cool stars that she called Class M. We leave those out because they produce no ultraviolet radiation. And remember the Fox and Miller experiment, you started with the box of goodies and you added energy. And if the star produces no ultraviolet radiation, it doesn't add any very suitable energy to the box of gases, which is the atmosphere of the planet. So we'll leave out the M stars. But that still leaves us with something like 10 billion stars. Not doing too badly. How many of those will have planets? Well, of course, we know our own sun has a system of planets in orbit around it. We have some very good indirect evidence that other nearby stars also have planets in orbit around them. Something like half the stars very close to the sun appear to have one or more planets. The one you detect is usually the thing like Jupiter, the big massive one. But where there are Jupiters, there are likely also to be Earths. So we guess that something like half of the suitable stars will in fact have planets in orbit around them. And that leaves us still with 5 billion stars to hunt among. How many of those will be life-sustaining? Well, that's a bit tricky because, again, we haven't actually made the virus that will eat biochemists, but we're working on it. And I think we will in due course. The stage I suspect one has to worry about is the following. The first cells that go running around eat goodies that were made by the ultraviolet radiation from the star in the fashion of the Fox and Miller experiment. But as they eat these goodies, they liberate some oxygen. Oxygen rises to the top of the planet's atmosphere and forms an ozone layer. You all know that ozone protects us from ultraviolet radiation. Of course, if you're a European, you feel that the ozone layer is being destroyed by the Americans with their aerosols. If you're an American, you feel that the ozone layer is being destroyed by the French and British with their Concorde. I'm not quite sure what Canadians are supposed to believe. Perhaps you don't have to believe either one. But in the days before the Earth had living creatures, there was no ozone layer, and the ultraviolet came in freely. The thing you have to worry about is that the creatures may eat up all the goodies and make an ozone layer before they have developed photosynthesis. And that may well happen something like half the time. Never mind, that still leaves us with 2 billion planets with life on. How many of those living creatures will develop civilization? I mean something funny by civilization. I do not mean the plays of Shakespeare or the late quartets of Beethoven or the science fiction of Fred Hoyle. What I mean by civilization is the ability to communicate outside your own planet. In other words, in effect, the development of radio and radar technology. We developed this now about 50 years ago, so that 50 light years out from the Earth is an ever-expanding shell of radio waves consisting of Caruso singing Che Lesta Aida and somebody advertising soap flakes. Now you know why no one has answered. But there seem to be on our Earth two intelligent species, us and the dolphins. And we have developed technology and the dolphins haven't. In other words, Lily spends a lot more time trying to talk to dolphins than dolphins spend trying to talk to Lily. And that probably says something, but I'm not quite sure what. But perhaps what it says is that roughly half of the intelligent species that develop actually turn out some technology so that they could communicate. That leaves us with something like 1 billion civilizations appearing over the age of our galaxy. How many of them are still around? Well, that's a bit tricky. The next large slide. The galaxy's been here 10 billion years. If we've developed something like a billion civilizations, then one civilization appears every 10 years. How many of them are still around? That depends on how long a civilization lives. We don't know that number. We hope that we won't know that number for a long time. At the moment, we can only put a lower limit on it. We can say that at least some civilizations live at least 50 years. I think it's entirely in the cards that we will destroy ourselves in another 50 years. Probably not even anything very glamorous like setting off bombs and blowing up the earth. More likely, all the garbage collectors in the whole world will go out on strike on the same day. And civilization will collapse completely, and we'll all, you know, all the government officials will die of typhoid. Actually, it's a thought that. I wonder if you can sort of buy the germs. Anyway, I think it is very much in the cards that we will not survive another 50 years, and that if we don't survive, it won't be anything very exciting like bombs. We'll just simply drown in our own garbage and exhaust all our sources of energy and become incapable of building radio telescopes and keeping civilization running and so forth. If it is so that the average civilization only lives something like 100 years, we are essentially alone in our galaxy. And there is no point in listening for signals, because by the time we receive them, the culture that sent them out is long since extinct. There is not much point in our trying to send signals, because by the time anyone received them, we would be extinct. That's a bit discouraging. On the other hand, perhaps we won't drown in our own garbage. We may solve the problem one way or another. The solution, of course, is to pay garbage professors what university professors get, and conversely. This would be an interesting experiment. I wonder how many university professors would rush to become garbage collectors under these circumstances.
They get paid more.
Some of them get paid more, he says. Okay. Not in California. Okay, the next possibility is that a civilization survives the timescale of biological evolution, the length of time it takes natural selection to turn one species into another. That's something like 10 million years. If you go back 10 million years, horse was Eohippus, and we were Zingiranthropus, and so on and so forth. If that's the case, then there's something like a million civilizations in our galaxy, and the nearest one is like 100 parsecs away. The parsec is a wonderful unit invented by the astronomers to confuse the enemy. What it means is that it would take something like 1,000 years to get a message there and back. In other words, if Queen Isabella, instead of sending Columbus off to the New World, had instead sent a radio message off to the nearest civilization under these circumstances, we could expect the answer any day. Of course, it wouldn't do Queen Isabella any good. And similarly, under these circumstances, if we try to communicate, it will be an act of faith in our descendants. It's like planting an olive tree. Traditional biblical good deed is to plant an olive tree because it can't possibly bear in your own lifetime. Similarly, if the nearest civilization is 100 parsecs away, you can't possibly get the answer back in your lifetime. There have been some preliminary efforts at communicating based on this sort of hypothesis, at least two in number. One, of course, was that the Pioneer that went off past Jupiter a year or so ago carried on it a little drawing. It was, in fact, a portrait of Carl Sagan and his wife, somewhat idealized. In fact, if you've seen Carl Sagan and his wife, you'll realize quite idealized. What happens, of course, is that the people on Jupiter pick up the plaque and look at it and say, gee, the Earth people are just like us, except they don't wear any clothes. And of course, they worship a giant spider. You'll only appreciate that if you've actually seen the plaque. The other sort of semi-serious effort on this scale that's been made at communicating was made by Frank Drake about a year ago. He took over the world's largest radio telescope and beamed a message in the direction of a cluster of stars which might, on this hypothesis, be expected to harbor several thousand civilizations. Again, the answer will not come back in our lifetime, even if there is one. But it's sort of an act of faith in the future to even send the message. The most favorable hypothesis is that a civilization lasts the entire age of the galaxy once it forms. If that's the case, then the whole billion are still around, and there may well be another civilization comparable with ours or more advanced within, say, 10 parsecs of us. That means you could get a message there and back in your own lifetime. If you were willing to spend the money, you could even get a rocket ship there and back in your own lifetime. We have the technology to do that. It's not very elegant. What you do is build a gigantic rocket ship and throw hydrogen bombs out the back and let them explode and shove the ship forward. It's not as elegant as some of the things that science fiction writers have suggested, but it is something we know how to do now, we could, in our own lifetimes, build a ship that, on this hypothesis, would go to the nearest civilization and come back in the lifetime of its crew. It would only cost sort of 1% of the gross national product of every advanced country for the next 10 or 15 years. Small compared with a war, in other words. And on the whole, I think the rewards would be greater than that of a war. But there are people who obviously who don't agree, or they would be doing this instead of fighting wars. Okay, on the most favorable hypothesis, the nearest civilization is quite close to us. And you can sort of ask, well, do we have any evidence that it exists? Some people have gone out and directly sought that evidence by pointing radio telescopes in the direction of nearby favorable stars and just listening. This was first done about 15 years ago by Frank Drake at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank. And he listened to two stars. He listened to Tau Ceti and Epsilon Eridani for about 100 hours. He called this Project Ozma, for the Queen of Oz that appears not in The Wizard of Oz, but in the subsequent books in the Oz series. Princess Ozma, in fact, first appears as a little boy named Jack. Small children aren't bothered by this sort of thing, I guess. My feeling is that small children are more sophisticated than they were when that book was written. Anyway, Frank Drake listened to these two stars, and people asked him what he'd learned. And he says, well, it's a little like the chap who came back from Mars. People asked him, is there any life on Mars? The man said, well, there's a little on Saturday night, but it's pretty quiet the rest of the time. From which you conclude that Mars is a lot like Vancouver. Anyway, what Frank Drake says, well, it was pretty quiet on Epsilon Eridani 11 years ago. Since then, a number of research groups, both here and in behind the Iron Curtain, have put in many hundreds of hours listening to promising stars. They have not reported hearing anything. On the other hand, the head of the American group, Ben Zuckerman of the University of Maryland, admits that even if he'd heard something, he wouldn't necessarily tell us. He's a little concerned about the sociological implications with society in its present disordered state of it being announced that there are, in fact, other civilizations in the universe. My own feeling is that his concern is misplaced, that the average person has now reached the stage where if you read on the front cover of your... What's the local newspaper?
Vancouver Sun.
On the cover of the Vancouver Sun, that civilization had been discovered at Tau Ceti, you would immediately turn past it to the sports page or the comics or, you know, whatever the good part is. But Zuckerman and others are not quite so sure about what the sociological implications of the discovery of other civilizations would be, and they want to give it a little thought in advance of actually coming up with the data. And perhaps it's something that we should all give a little thought to, not a lot. It's like the sun running out of energy. You shouldn't worry about it immediately, but it's something you might want to think about at 3 o'clock in the morning sometime when you get tired of counting sheep. Okay, in the most favorable case, there are many other civilizations in our galaxy. Even in the most unfavorable case, we know there's at least one. There is surely us. And we seem to be the product of this very natural chain of events that went from the Big Bang to the formation of galaxies, to the formation of stars that made heavy elements, to the formation of more stars with planets and with the raw materials of living creatures and natural selection and so on and so forth. The curious thing is that this whole chain of events requires that the universe be very much the way it is. You might think the universe as a whole was so complicated that you couldn't hope to get hold of what its fundamental properties are. But in fact, it seems that all the behavior of matter and radiation and everything, all the complexity of galaxies and stars and planets and people and all the rest of it, are determined by only 8 fundamental properties of the universe. The next large slide should be the first 4 of those properties. Those are the forces by which atoms interact. Those are sort of small-scale properties of the universe. They are the 4 forces of nature. Gravity is, of course, familiar to you. You experience it every time you fall downstairs. It holds you in your seat. It keeps the roof from rising off the top of your house and so forth. Gravity always pulls things together. It's always attractive. It affects everything. and its range is infinitely distant. Any two particles anywhere in the universe have a gravitational force between them. It is, however, exceedingly weak. It is the weakest of the four forces. And it's only because it's always attractive, long range, and affects everything that it does dominate large-scale phenomena, like the orbit of the Earth around the Sun and the orbit of the Sun in the galaxy and so forth. The next of the four forces is also familiar to you. It's the electromagnetic force. You experience it whenever you stick your finger in a light socket. The first thing I learned when I went to England is that 220 volts is more of a surprise than 110. I learned this in the process of discovering that their light bulbs don't unscrew. They sort of sproing in and out if you're lucky. You also experience the electromagnetic force when you accidentally leave your wristwatch next to a magnet overnight and have to take your wristwatch to a wristwatch doctor. It's the electromagnetic force that controls the structure of atoms and molecules. It's the electric force between the protons in the nucleus and the electrons in the outer part of the atom that make atoms what they are. And since we are chemical creatures who live by undergoing chemical reactions, it's the electromagnetic force that determines what it is that happens to your dinner when you eat it and it becomes digested and horrible things happen. Our entire bodily structure and our nervous system, which also works partly by chemistry and partly by electrical impulses, all of this is determined by the electromagnetic interaction. So that one, too, is very familiar to you. The third force is the so-called nuclear force. It's perhaps a little less familiar, but there must be something of the sort because, after all, the centers of atoms, the nuclei of atoms, contain only protons and neutrons, all positive charges. And like charges repel, famous principle, like charges repel, unlike charges attract. So if the electromagnetic force were the only thing there was in atoms, the nuclei of the atoms would immediately fall apart, protons repelling each other. It's the nuclear force that holds the nuclei of atoms together. It's also, of course, the nuclear force that makes nuclear reactions take place. The burning of helium to make carbon and oxygen in stars. That's very important. If the nuclear force weren't just what it is, you'd either get all carbon or all oxygen and not the mix that we need. Of course, it's also the nuclear force that makes fission bombs work and so forth. From our point of view, it's a vital force because it holds the atoms together. The weak interaction, the fourth force of nature, is undoubtedly the least familiar to you, the weak interaction. So without the weak interaction, stars wouldn't burn, and they certainly wouldn't supernova. The next large slide, those are the other four properties that determine the universe. Those are the large-scale ones, the things that apply to the universe as a whole. The first one I've called H naught. H stands for Hubble's constant, so-called because it was discovered by Lundmark, who didn't have a very good press agent. It measures the rate of expansion of the universe. That is, it measures the age of the universe. It's Hubble's constant that tells us that the hot, dense phase was about 20 billion years ago. So that's a time scale measurement. The second one is the average density of matter in the universe, the thing that I told you was sort of one atom per every cubic meter. Notice that I've got a range of numbers up there. We don't actually know the density of matter in the universe to within a factor of 10 or so either way. But it's something like 10 to the minus 31 grams per cc, or one atom per cubic meter, the average density of matter in the universe. There's a funny relationship between the density, Hubble's constant, and the constant that tells you how strong gravity is. I've written it up there with a twiddles because it's only approximately equal to 1 since we don't know the density very well. But those tremendous numbers that are so very different from one, that simple combination of them is almost exactly equal to unity, and it's possible that's trying to tell us something about the universe. The third property there I've called photons per baryon. Another way of saying it is entropy. A third way of saying it is the temperature of the universe. Remember our original hot, dense state. This tells us how hot it was. The fourth property I've called isotropy and homogeneity. Homogeneity is not something to do with milk. It just merely means the same every place. Isotropy means the same in all directions. The universe is expanding very uniformly in all directions, and that property also seems to be vital. Now, what happens if we start twiddling with these eight properties? Can you back up to the previous slide for a second? Suppose gravity were much stronger than it is. What would happen? Well, stars would be held together so tightly that they would burn all their nuclear fuel very quickly. There would be no time for life to develop. On the other hand, if gravity were very weak, the center of a star would never get hot enough for any nuclear reactions. There would be no source of energy for living creatures. Suppose the electromagnetic interaction were different. Suppose it were very strong. All the electrons would be pulled down inside the nucleus. There would be no orbital electrons. There would be no chemistry, no way for atoms to interact. On the other hand, if the electromagnetic force were weak, the electrons would all just drift away off into space. And again, there would be no atoms, no molecules, no chemistry. We surely wouldn't be here. If you even change the electromagnetic interaction by a factor of 3, water is not a liquid at any temperature. And of course, water is such a beautiful solvent, one would be sort of hard-pressed to know how to do without it and still make anything like terrestrial living creatures. If you fool with the nuclear force, on the one hand, stars all turn to iron immediately, and that isn't very interesting. On the other hand, again, they don't get any reactions going. There's no source of light or heat. The weak interaction, if it were too strong, the hot Big Bang would have turned everything to helium. Again, there would be no source of energy in stars. If it were too weak, the reaction that turns hydrogen to helium wouldn't go, and there'd be no source of energy. Can I have the last slide back again? Similarly, if you diddle with any of these, we just wouldn't be here. If you made the expansion rate go too fast, the galaxies could never form, and you'd just be a lonely little hydrogen atom wandering through intergalactic space, and you'd never meet another hydrogen atom. Actually, there are days when this sort of has its charms. On the other hand, if the expansion went too slowly, the initial hot, dense stage would have turned everything into iron, and would be sort of giant lumps of stainless steel sitting here going, rusting away. If you fiddle with the density, if it's too low, galaxies never form. If it's too high, the expansion goes so fast that there's no time for life to develop. Similarly, if you diddle with the temperature, if you make it too low, the initial hot Big Bang turns everything to iron. If you make the temperature too high, galaxies never get a chance to form. Similarly, if you diddle with the isotropy, again, you never get any galaxies forming, and you're a poor little hydrogen atom wandering lonely as a cloud. So if you play with any of these 8 fundamental forces of nature, these 8 fundamental properties, we simply wouldn't be here. Can I have the lights, please? And you can ask, what, if anything, does this mean, that the universe should be so delicately balanced that we actually are here? You can think of several things it might mean. Of course, it might just mean that God has been very careful to arrange the universe very nicely for us. And that's a possible hypothesis, but it doesn't lead you anywhere. It doesn't sort of invite you to do any further calculations or any further observations or any further experiments. It's a dead end as a hypothesis. And therefore, in some sense, it's not a scientific hypothesis, because what you always want is something that will lead you to the next question or to the next experiment. Another possibility is that ours is just one of many universes. And it's only a very rare, special, nice universe like ours that has people in it that ask these damn fool questions. There are 2 ways we could be one of many universes. There might be many universes existing simultaneously in space. I don't mean many solar systems or many galaxies. We've already talked about that. I mean many genuinely independent, 4-dimensional space-time universes simultaneously existing and embedded in some higher dimension, some 5- or 6-dimensional space. We could never, under any circumstances, communicate with any of these other universes. The other possibility is that one universe exists after another in time, that the universe alternatively expands and contracts. This violates general relativity, but don't worry about that. And that it's only an occasional, very special, favorable cycle in which living creatures develop and ask these questions. We might be one of many universes and just a very lucky one. Another possibility is that if we had thoroughly understood the physics, we would realize that the universe really has to be the way it is. And the existence of this funny relationship I showed you between gravity and the Hubble constant and the density does somehow suggest that there may be some physics that we haven't understood. And if we did, we would realize that this relationship had to be the way it is, and the universe has to be the way it is. There are some other similarly funny relationships. one that was just discovered a couple of months ago by a chap named Fallon at Johns Hopkins, involves the electromagnetic constant, the gravitational constant, and, believe it or not, the reduced mass of the mu meson. It therefore involves three of the four fundamental forces, the weak interaction, gravity, and electromagnetism. It's another one of these things where you take a bunch of numbers very different from one, multiply them together, and you get one, not just approximately this time, but to about five significant figures, which is as well as you know gravity. And the existence of these relationships implies, possibly, that we haven't understood all the physics, and that when we did, we would realize that the universe really has to be the way it is. That is, in some sense, the Princeton viewpoint. In other words, that's what Johnny Wheeler says at lunch when he's had a martini or two. There's one other alternative we can call the Caltech viewpoint. That's what Feynman says when he's had a martini or two at lunch. And his viewpoint is that intelligence is an inevitable result of sufficient complexity. He takes as an example a poor innocent little water molecule sitting there with its hydrogens making the 105 degree angle that we all learned about in school. I don't know if it's true or not, but I was told it in school, so I believe it. That's what you have to do with things that are not your own subject, of course. You just have to trust that people will tell you the truth most of the time. And what Feynman says is that however well you understand the structure of one molecule of water, you could never in any way predict the existence of things like waterfalls or the complexity of nice surfing waves in the ocean. He says that just the very fact of having many particles interacting produces complexity that you could not otherwise have predicted, and if you just have enough particles, you will have something that we would regard as intelligence. And he suggests, for instance, that if the universe had a much stronger gravitational constant and a much stronger nuclear interaction, so that everything had immediately been converted to neutron star matter, we would be gigantic lumps of neutron star matter talking in very low tones, and we would look back at our universe and say, well, there can't possibly be any living creatures there. The density isn't high enough. So that's the fourth possibility, that wherever you have enough particles, that is, in any universe, you will inevitably get the kind of complexity that one regards as intelligence. I don't know whether any of those four is the right answer, or if any of them is, which it is. But again, it's the sort of thing that one can think about at 3 o'clock in the morning when you're tired of counting sheep. I think this is really all I have to say on the subject, but if there are questions or comments or rude remarks or any other kind of feedback, I'd be happy to try and respond to it.
We will have our usual question period now, and I'm sure there are lots. Yes.
I just heard on the Stephen Stein show a few days ago, somebody was claiming that hydrogen fusion doesn't take place in stars.
I'm happy to report that this is a false alarm. In fact, it's the result of a press release that came out just after the nick of time. The press release came from Don Clayton at Rice University, Houston, Texas, and he had evolved a beautiful new hypothesis to explain a problem that turns out not to be there. The problem was an experiment by Ray Davis of the Brookhaven National Laboratory to detect neutrinos coming from the sun. You do this, believe it or not, by building a 100,000-gallon tank of cleaning fluid and taking it down to the bottom of a gold mine and sitting and waiting. Well, Davis waited about 7 years before he saw his first neutrino, and he had really just about given up. And lots of people had come up with theories to explain why he wasn't seeing any neutrinos, except perhaps he was looking the wrong way. And then about 6 weeks ago, Davis just started seeing the neutrinos. So the problem has apparently gone away. He finally got his experiment working in the way it should have worked first, sort of 7 years ago. And he's now seeing about the expected number of neutrinos. And just after the nick of time, Clayton came up with this beautiful theory that there was a black hole at the center of the sun that was making the energy instead of nuclear reactions to explain the absence of neutrinos, which is no longer a problem. This happens very often, incidentally, that an observer will get up at a conference and show up some sort of a graph like... that sort of thing. And five theorists will have a theory to explain the blip when he says that was a truck that went past. So that was in practically all the papers just after the nick of time. And I hope Ray Davis will get out his news release pretty soon and try to catch up with the Clayton one.
Other questions?
You've been reading Scientific American. The January issue has an article by Van Flandern, which starts out with really an excellent review of the observational problems, and then suddenly goes a little funny. And I do think possibly the editor should have added a footnote to explain that Van Flandern is practically alone in his interpretation of the results. Well, they are, of course, his results, so he's entitled to an interpretation. But the problem is the following. What Van Flandern has measured is the slowing down of the Earth's rotation and the drift of the moon gradually away from the Earth. We've known for a couple hundred years that this is happening, and a good part of it is due to tidal drag, to the moon pulling the Earth's oceans around and slopping about, and this just drags on the Earth's rotation, slows it down. The difficulty with Van Flandern's data, in which he tries to correct for this effect and have some effect left over, which he attributes to gravity becoming weaker, is, of course, that you've somehow got to calculate this amount of slop of the oceans and how much that slows down the Earth's rotation. And you can understand that since there are a lot of oceans and they're all rather complicated, this is not an easy calculation to do. Another thing he has to assume is that the distribution of matter inside the Earth doesn't change with time. And since the geologists now tell us about things like plate tectonics and currents of lava and molten mantle rising and falling in the Earth, the assumption that the Earth's internal structure doesn't change with time is almost certainly wrong. And one has to allow for that effect before you can interpret his data to say that the constant of gravity is changing. I think there's no question that the data is right. He's a careful observer associated with the Naval Observatory, where most of the observations have actually been made. So I think there's no question that the data is right, but I think his interpretation should be treated with some caution until the geophysicists get in there and tell us how much the Earth's internal structure is changing and a variety of other similar problems. Oh, antimatter is lovely stuff. You can make it in the laboratory. There's no question that it exists. It almost certainly does not exist in our laboratory, in our universe, except where people have made it in the laboratory. Various times in the past, people have had theories of the universe in which there were both galaxies and anti-galaxies in equal numbers. The difficulty, of course, is in getting the matter and the antimatter both out of the hot, dense, early stage without having them annihilate each other. There was a chap in Paris named Roland Omnes who thought he had solved the problem with a phenomenon that was sort of like an emulsion, the separation of oil and water in salad dressing. And he thought he could separate the matter and the antimatter in a sort of a salad dressing universe. He recently recanted. He no longer feels he can separate matter and antimatter. And now neither does really anybody else except Hans Alfvén in Sweden. And when he dies, there will be nobody left who believes you can. Don't you realize this is how theories triumph? Their supporters outlive all their opponents. Anyway, no one now sees any way to get anti-galaxies and galaxies out of the Big Bang at the same time. So the evidence seems to be that antimatter certainly exists. You can make it in the laboratory, but there isn't very much of it in our universe. The high surface temperature, of course, is a...
Repeat the question.
Oh, he reads Velikovsky and wants to know about Venus. right? Venus is hot because It has an atmosphere with lots and lots of carbon dioxide in it, and of course because it's closer to the sun than we are. The Earth's primitive atmosphere was also very different from the atmosphere it has now. The Earth's present atmosphere is in large measure a direct product of the living creatures on Earth who have eaten up the carbon dioxide and turned it into oxygen and other things. Incidentally, the implication of this is that if we burn all the fossil fuels, all the carbon that's been laid down in the form of coal and oil, we will return our atmosphere to its original pure carbon dioxide state. This is perhaps something to worry about. I don't know. Unless the plankton in the ocean can keep up with it and continue to produce plankton, in case we may drown in plankton. Anyway, in the case of Venus, nothing like this has ever happened to turn the atmosphere into something more transparent than the original atmosphere, and therefore solar radiation goes in and doesn't get out again, and it gets very hot. And this has been known now observationally from the radio astronomers for about 20 years. Everybody else didn't realize it thoroughly until the Russians dropped a probe onto the surface and it melted before it got there. Temperature something like 700 degrees. It melts lead and solder and various other sort of soft metals. The rotation of Venus is almost zero. Its rotation period is very slow. And most of the people who've thought about angular momentum in the universe believe that planets formed out of half a dozen or so protoplanetary chunks which crashed into one another and stuck. And what seems to have happened in the case of Venus is that the last chunk that hit happened to be going the other direction. And so things came to a sort of a shuddering halt, like two very rapid streams of traffic crossing the same intersection. On Velikovsky, I think my only statement is that if I'm in a spaceship between here and Venus, and the spaceship has to have its course corrected a little bit, I think I would rather have a navigator who believed in Newtonian mechanics than a navigator who believed in Velikovskian mechanics. Velikovsky's forces of gravity and electromagnetic forces do not fall off as 1 over r squared. And if you try to navigate a spaceship with a theory of gravity that doesn't fall off as 1 over r squared, I suspect you're going to have problems. Mm-hmm.
In the middle between the Vega and the base model. To come back to your question, how many other universes there are, could it not be said that had that human been in some other position vis-a-vis the other scales, there may be other universes, but there wouldn't be the human ones?
Again, by universe, I mean the four-dimensional space-time with which we can communicate. Yes. Not because of our human nature, but because of the way light propagates. By communicate, I mean something that's physics and not humanity. Any other universe would be something from which we could not receive light signals and to which we could not send light signals. If they had very different values of the constants of nature, any living creatures they had would certainly be very different sizes, just as you cannot build, for instance, a butterfly as big as an elephant because there's no way for it to get oxygen. You could not build a human being that was very large or very small. Either it would splatter down onto the ground or it would lose heat so rapidly from its surface that it would have to eat continuously like a tree shrew. So the size scales of terrestrial living creatures are very much set by these eight fundamental properties. And if you had a different universe with those constants having different values, your creatures would certainly be different sizes, different masses, and very possibly have different senses of time.
Maybe sort of a frivolous question, but what is the, based on these constants, what is the future of the universe?
He wants to know what the future of the universe is. Our little corner, it may be fairly bleak, but the universe as a whole really has only two choices. Either it keeps expanding or it turns around and recontracts. And there's a large population of cosmologists who feels it's their business to find out whether the universe will expand forever or turn around and recontract. Which side is winning is one of these, to a certain extent, one of these things where you have to outlive your opponents. I believe that the youngest astronomers, and therefore the ones who will win in the short run, now believe that the universe will expand forever. I must say that they have a fairly nice body of data supporting this, of various kinds. Some of it very large scale, like looking at redshifts of very distant galaxies. Some of it quite small scale, like trying to figure out where the deuterium came from. But there are several different lines of evidence that now suggest that our universe will probably expand forever rather than turn around and recontract. It never happened. You don't get smaller ones. He asked about the breakup of stars, but since it doesn't happen, I don't think I want to try and discuss it.
Stars are continually forming.
Stars continue and die. But it is not the case that a large star breaks up and its material is then directly turned into other smaller stars. That isn't the way it works. I don't think black holes have very much effect on the evolution of our galaxy. In the vicinity of the sun, you can put some upper limits that say not more than 10% of the mass is collapsed into black holes at the present time. And if you then ask how much more stuff could they gobble up between now and, say, the time the sun runs out of energy, the answer is not very much. The galaxy will run out of raw materials and all its stars will have died natural deaths before any black holes that are now present could eat up a very large fraction of the matter. So in that sense, I think their effect on the evolution of galaxies in the universe is not very important. If we live in the kind of universe that's going to recontract, we're already inside one big black hole. But again, such data as exists at the moment suggests that the universe isn't like that and it will expand forever, so we're not inside a big black hole. He's asking about sort of the opposite of black holes. And for a while, people talked about things called white holes, which were the time reversal of black holes. It turns out this doesn't work. A white hole has only to capture one little photon or one little hydrogen atom to turn itself immediately into a black hole. There's another question about the stability of black holes, and there's a chap in England named Steve Hawking who has suggested that small black holes will eventually boil away. He's not talking about the kind of black holes that I sort of showed there being formed from stars. He's talking about tiny black holes that were formed in the Big Bang itself. Of course, there may never have been any of those. If there were, they are boiling away. But again, the amount of matter that they contain is small, and so their effect on the overall evolution of the galaxy is small. They may occasionally give rise to bursts of gamma rays or something that one could observe. He's asking about theories competing with the Big Bang and who is winning on that one. Once again, all I mean, and I think all anyone who really thinks about the problem can mean by Big Bang, is that there was a time about 20 billion years ago when the universe was much hotter and much denser than it is now. And I think the observational evidence for that, in terms of the abundance of helium and the presence of the black body radiation, is very strong. There was a competing theory called steady state, associated, of course, largely with the name of Fred Hoyle and with Hermann Bondi and Tommy Gold and so forth. It was a beautiful theory, It was emotionally comforting somehow. It appealed to our deepest psychological needs, but it did not agree with observations. And one of the things that we like to think we mean by doing science for a living is that when one of our cherished pet ideas doesn't agree with observations, we either give up the idea or we have a nervous breakdown. We do not, at any rate, pretend that the observations don't exist. So from that point of view, a theory of the universe that does not include the early hot dense state just doesn't agree with observations, and one has to give it up in some sense. He asks about the rate of supernovae. In a typical large galaxy like ours, somewhere in the galaxy there's a supernova about every 30 years. Typically, only maybe 1 in 10 of those occurs in a part of the galaxy that we can readily observe. So that supernovae in our galaxy that have been observed by people occur about once every 300 years. There was one in the year 1006. There was one in 1054. There was one seen by Tycho in 15-something. There was one seen by Kepler in 16-something. In some sense, we're overdue for another naked eye one. But the total rate, if you allow for the ones that we don't readily observe, is something like one every 30 years per typical big galaxy. That's just about what you need to put out the amount of heavy elements that we actually see. It all makes a certain amount of sense.
Professor Dempster?
More comforting aspects of steady state theories versus the slightly uncomfortable features of the Big Bang kind of theory. What are now the feelings about the confidence that we can put in the sort of basic laws of physics during the early stages of the universe?
It varies a lot depending on how early you want to be and how precisely you want things not to have changed. From the observations of emission and absorption lines in distant galaxies and quasars, we can say, for instance, the fine structure constant hasn't changed by more than a couple of percent over the past 5 billion years. The abundance of helium in the universe suggests that the laws of nuclear physics have not changed much in the past 20 billion years. The fact that when we look at distant galaxies, they're about as bright as our galaxy suggests both that the laws of nuclear physics and the strength of gravity haven't changed much in the past, say, 5 or 10 billion years. The fact that the Earth's temperature has been very constant over the past 3 or 4 billion years suggests that the laws of physics haven't changed much. I think you cannot say anything about factors of 2 20 billion years ago. What are quasars? They're marvelous for press releases. They appear to be a phase in the formation of elliptical galaxies where material has sort of 9/10 been turned into stars, and the last odd tenth of the galaxy's gas falls into the center rather rapidly and forms massive stars which then go off in a rapid series of supernovae.
Will you bet on that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll also bet money on whether or not there's a black hole in Cygnus X1, but I shan't tell you which side I'm betting on.
Other questions? Yes.
Yeah. That's
a very interesting one. That is a press release that went haywire, because the guy from CBC I talked to yesterday said the same thing. The X-ray bursts are not coming from the center of the galaxy. Some of them are known to be coming from a previously identified X-ray source, which happens to be in a globular cluster, a group of old stars, which is in the same general direction in the sky as the galactic center, but it's not at the galactic center. A good many of the bursts come from random directions in space from no particular known object. The periodic ones were the ones from the globular cluster. The non-periodic ones could be coming from almost anything. And frankly, there is no decent theory of them. There's some very nice suggestions, like, for instance, comets crashing onto the surfaces of neutron stars. Or Hawking's little black holes finally boiling away would make bursts of gamma or X-rays. People have suggested dust grains propelled at the speed of light crashing into things. There are lots of theories, but I think none of them is very convincing. But I don't quite know what went wrong that everyone in Vancouver seems to have heard that the bursts were coming from the center of the galaxy. Some sort of malfunction in the press line somehow.
Yes.
Yes, once upon a time, he's asking about new elements. Once upon a time, there were holes in the periodic chart, and one of Mendeleev's great contributions was to predict that something which he called eca-silicon would exist, an element with the properties of silicon, but rather heavier. We now call it germanium. He predicted eca-boron, which we now call aluminum. There are no more holes left in the periodic table up through number 106. And so the search for new elements has to concentrate on elements heavier than 106, which doesn't yet have a name because it's now reached the stage where the new elements are simultaneously discovered by Glenn Seaborg and somebody in Russia, and they can never agree on the name. You understand that the two main candidates are, of course, always Seaborgium and Tchaikovskyum or some such. There is a problem about naming elements at the moment. The most interesting kind of new element that people are now looking for is along about element 114, which people think may be very, very stable. Most of the elements on beyond uranium only live a few seconds in the laboratory, but a number of theorists working independently have suggested that the elements around 114 would have long lifetimes. And so that would be a new kind of element that would be very interesting to find.
Will you bet on that one, too?
Yes. Yeah, my bet is that lifetime is around 10 to the 4 years. It isn't enough to make them cosmologically interesting, but they certainly would have interesting terrestrial applications. Oh, yeah, you have that funny colored money here. It took me about 2 hours to realize I was in a foreign country, and suddenly all the currency was funny colors. Something dawned on me. And then a shop assistant called me Ducky, and I made a bit of an influx of the Brits here. Yes, I'm happy to pay off in Canadian currency. Real money I'm more careful with.
Are there other questions?
Okay. Well, perhaps sometime we'll have to tell you who won the War of 1812.
I thought it was the Indians.
Yeah.